History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. By now, we've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. You really never know where that conversation might lead, and today's episode is going to be a powerful example of that. Our goal, above all, is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Last time, we met a 97-year-old Montana cowboy named Durrell Gibbs, who survived the Battle of Okinawa in World War II. There is a much more recent chapter to his story that we didn't have time for, but we're going to explore that today with Durrell and his son, Wes. If you missed the first part of Durrell's story, you can access it online at hometownheroesradio.com. But the key moment that today's episode is going to center around came in his foxhole on Okinawa in 1945.
I'd done my watch, and I was trying to get a little shut-eye, and Sergeant was standing there doing his watch, and all of a sudden, I was just being walked on, and I was hearing him grunt, and a Jap soldier had crawled up, and it was a hand-to-hand situation. I come up out of that hole. Well, there was two of us, and it was pretty dark night. That Jap, he died right there. Laid him off the side of the hole, and we spent the rest of the night. The next morning, real early, we was going to move out, and I seen that that Jap soldier had a pistol, so I wanted, it was always for souvenirs, so I wanted to get that pistol. While I was taking that pistol off of him, he had a wallet up here on his jacket or whatever they call him, in a pocket, and that wallet was really protected. It had a heavy cloth and cut fancy. That wallet surprised me, and so I was getting a pistol. I just put that wallet in my pocket, and we was moving out, and I never thought any more about it.
But he brought it home, and to understand how that wallet would end up changing many lives, we need to bring in Durrell's son, Wes. And let's start with this. How old do you think you were, Wes, when you started to understand that your dad had served in World War II?
Probably the earliest days of being a little boy and playing outside. My brother was 3 years older than me, so we were good buddies, you know. And I mean, when we were 4, 5, and 6, we were playing Army and playing outside, and Dad had a little suitcase that he brought back home with some things from the war inside there. And so we were always kind of looking at that stuff. And, you know, back then playing war, Mom had gotten us a couple of little Army helmets, and, you know, that was a big deal for us. And somewhere in there, I became aware that Dad had been a soldier, and I was really proud of that, really excited about that. You know, soldiers were all heroes in my mind, and to know that he had done that. So, yeah, I would say 4 or 5 on up.
Did he ever tell you much about what he'd done over there?
No, you know, I always wanted to know more, especially when I was 10, 11, 12, you know, a teenager. Dad would share some incidents, but usually they were incidents of funny things. You know, I wanted to know more about particular battlefield incidents, but he never did share too much of that.
And what are some of the things you remember being in that box that you got to play with or explore?
Well, I remember there were some of his medals, awards in there, and you know, my brother and I, Dad also had a trunk with his uniform, and, you know, I'm sad to say now, we wore those things around, and he kind of knew we were wearing those, and unfortunately, they didn't get saved. I still have his dress hat, and I remember there were some photographs from the war. There was the wallet that he's talked a little about. He didn't try to keep us from looking in there, but he always made sure that we, at least on that item, kept it special. We weren't allowed to play with it. We could look in it. I remember from the earliest time that we looked in it, the photographs were in there that always caught our attention, and there was a piece of Japanese money, some currency in there, but the pictures I remember mostly.
And did he tell you what it was or how he got it, or was just this kind of mysterious wallet that you knew you were supposed to be careful with?
Yeah, you know, I think all I knew at the time was that he had taken it from a dead Japanese soldier. So probably I was a young adult when I fully understood that. But we knew back at that time that it had come from a dead Japanese soldier. And even back then, he had expressed interest in knowing more about that family and possibly getting it back to the family of that soldier. And it just boggled my mind how, first of all, you know, how he would think that that would ever be possible and why he would want that to happen. I just couldn't quite grasp that.
So Wes says he had a hard time understanding why you thought it would even be possible to reunite this wallet with the family. Or why that even mattered to you. Can you help us understand that?
I don't know why it mattered. It was over a period of years as these kids were growing up. And here's this wallet with pictures of kids that he had on them. And the way the wallet was, it wasn't just stuffed in a pocket. The way he had it, I could tell that that wallet meant a lot to him. That's why I took it to begin with. Well, I didn't even think. I was taking the pistol, the wallet was there, and it was outstanding, and I just put it in my pocket. It was a slow process because I didn't think anything about it then. And when I got home, the pistol got stolen in a couple of years, but the wallet was always down there in the box. The wallet was always there. Nothing happened to it. Why? I didn't have anything. The other things was all gone. And as the kids were growing up, it just slowly dawned. And I knew I could see all those pictures of those kids. And I thought, well, here, my kids are growing up. I wonder what kind of family that soldier had. And where it was as personal as it was, that made all the difference, see? And yet, I thought how great it would be if that wallet went back with that to that family. But there was no chance of that. You know, I wasn't going over there. Wes always wanted to go. But the opportunities never arose. That's why I think the Lord, there was too many things had to happen for that to happen. And I think the Lord had a hand in it.
So when did this really start to take shape? When did it go from this idea that's out there that, yeah, that would be nice, but there's no way, to, hey, something's happening here?
Well, yeah, a little before, in my 30s or so, when Dad and I would get together, and I'm a history buff, and, you know, I would try to talk more about his war experiences. I just had a curiosity, wanted to know more, and kind of heard the same stories we'd heard as kids. But then one time Dad was visiting me, and I got on my laptop computer, and I discovered the 96th Infantry. I started just doing a little research. 96th Infantry had a website, and there were some photographs on the webpage of some recent trips by veterans back to the battlefield. And I just became just obsessed almost with the fact that I would really like to go back. You know, I was aware of another incident where a man that I had become aware of had traveled back, and just how meaningful that seemed to be for him. And so I guess it was two parts. I wanted to take Dad back and thought maybe he would like to see that area again. And then I just really wanted, before anything happened to Dad, to be back on the same places and maybe hear some more stories and hear stories that I hadn't heard and experience that with him.
Had you ever thought about going back to Okinawa?
No. I didn't see any way that I could possibly go back to Okinawa. I was really concentrating on building a ranch, getting a ranch paid for. Then opportunity just come out of nowhere. Wes can tell you about the opportunities, you know, because we were able to get back, but it was nothing that we could have planned.
What I thought was pretty interesting, though, every time Dad and I would get together, and my mother had passed away, so when Dad and I would get together, you know, we'd talk about the possibility of ever going back. You know, he always brought up the fact that he'd like to try to get that wallet back somehow to whoever that soldier's family was, and so that always kind of impressed me. And so probably about 10 years or so after I really began to feel the strong desire to somehow make that happen, the guy that I worked for at the time, I had a lot of frequent flyer miles built up, and I was always sharing with him incident stories of my dad, sharing with him the desire that I had to take him back there and go back with him. And so lo and behold, here Christmas of 2010, my boss at the time, Andre Giles, says, "Hey, Wes, I want you to have these two round-trip tickets to Okinawa. for Christmas? You go do it. You take your dad and you go back there. It just floored me.
I've heard of Christmas bonuses, but not like that.
Well, so then it was exciting when I had those and couldn't wait to give Dad a call and say, hey, I've got 2 round-trip tickets to Okinawa, so we're going to do this.
And what did you say?
Oh, I thought that was great. Well, that was kind of way out. Well, it was just unbelievable. But Wes is the one that really brought it about. And yeah, it was exciting. And the way things build up so that we could go, you're telling about the tsunami and things like that, see?
Yeah, there's all this hope, here we go. And then there's a, whoa, wait a second, what's going on?
Well, there was a little bit of planning involved. Once I had the tickets, I began in earnest then to really try to make it come about. And the first thing I did is I wanted to determine when the best time to visit Japan was. And I didn't want to make it too far out. You know, Christmas is when I got the tickets or when he made me aware of it. And so, you know, I determined just through doing research that January, you know, was a really good time to visit that country. And so then just began to sweep over me. How am I going to do this? You know, how are we going to drive? How are we going to get around? Once we get there, where are we going to stay? There's so many unknowns, and at times there was almost an overwhelming feeling, but I wanted to go so bad, and here it was just 3 weeks away, basically. We decided to set January 20th as the time when we would go, and so I just began in earnest to try to accomplish that. I first contacted some military bases to see if there's a possibility that we could stay on some of the Marine bases there, and I said, I'm bringing my dad back. He's a veteran of the battle, and I never got much accommodation, you know, and I thought that would be kind of easy, a no-brainer maybe, but, and so it was just began some red tape, and well, you got to put in a request, and anyway, I began to lose a little bit of hope on that. And then so actually one day, just about, oh, maybe 10 days before we were going to leave, it was like throwing a bottle out into the ocean. I had come across, and every night I would research the internet for more information. I'd come across the names of a couple of former Marines who were living in Okinawa and had served as tour guides for another ex-military person. I just came on this information. And so I threw an email out to one of those guys, found out later it was an old email address, and he didn't even see my email until about 2 days before we got there. And then I became aware of another group in Okinawa that was a research group that helped bring back artifacts taken during the war that would help determine where they needed to return to. And I threw an email out to that group. And so for several days, I never heard back from either of those until, I mean, literally days before we were to leave and just go make it happen, I got an email from both of those places literally just days before we were to leave, and it actually took all of the pressure off. The former Marine said, yes, we're still here, absolutely. Our priority is to help former veterans see their where they served, and you will have 2 guides full-time for the entire 5 days you're here, plus our vehicle. You don't worry about a thing. The research group, which is led by Alex Kishaba, who is a native of Okinawa, he was excited about the wallet. He wanted to try to do whatever he could to help us find who that wallet had belonged to. Dad was so set on getting that back. I knew that if we didn't try to make an earnest effort to identify the owner of that wallet, that he'd be disappointed. And in saying that, I didn't have any hope that we could. I just thought, that is so far out there. The little bit of reading I'd done, I'd realized 110,000 Japanese died, you know, ended up just going into the soil of the island. And how in the world could we ever identify one of those? There was some writing on the back of some of the pictures. And so Alex had me send them him copies of the photographs and that writing. And so some hope began to build in that. Actually, just days before we were to leave, there was 2 really promises of good things happening.
But it sounds like you're saying you were just trying to research the wallet to get him off your back so he wouldn't be mad at you.
Well, maybe a little, but I truly did want to make an earnest effort.
What was it like for you, Durrell, when you got there? This island that you haven't been on in 66 years, what was that like for you?
Well, I couldn't believe how it had been built up. All of those little towns and all those places was totally bombed out and destroyed, even to the point of walls standing. And fleas and bugs, everything. And then here we come back, and I couldn't believe the progress that had been made in restoring those towns. There's a couple more incidents that I think is really needs to be told about the fight while I was there. One of them just come to me when I was thinking about fleas and the bugs and that. Before we would go through one of those bombed out towns as we was going across the island, cleaning the Japanese out of the island, we had little cans of DDT. And, you know, look what they think about today. We didn't think anything about. We would dust ourselves with that DDT all over, sprinkle it all over us, and so that when we went through, we could come out the other side halfway clean, you know, keep them bugs away from us. We'd just come through this town, really had been shelled and bombed on the edge of the town. Here's a young lady, a young woman, was laying there dead right along. And there was a little boy, probably 3 years old, and he was sitting there holding her hand, crying. And his face was just really dusty, you know, from the bombs created a lot of dust. And his face was really dusty. Down his cheeks, where the tears had run, was little places, you know, had run down and dripped off his chin. We was under sniper fire, so we had to keep him moving. But we was a whole bunch of kids. As I look back now, there was one guy there that had a family, that was married and had a family. None of the rest of us was. He called him Tobe. He had a family at home, and we thought he was an old man. How come he was still there? Well, we just worked by her. And when Tobe, he was right there by me. Tobe come, and he looked down at that little boy, and he crying. And Tobe just reached out his hand like that. That little kid let go of his mom and reached up and got Tobe's hand. And the last I seen, they were walking on down the road, that little kid with him.
Makes you wonder what ended up happening to that young boy, huh?
Yes, those kind of things is what brought all of this stuff with the wallet.
Yeah, that wallet, as it turns out, would hold the power to connect two families on opposite sides of the world. And 80 years ago, on opposite sides of World War II. We're going to explain how with Wes and Durrell Gibbs when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the kind of story today that you just can't make up. It is captured in a book called A Soldier's Journey that Wes Gibbs has written about his father. If you'd like to order a copy, go to hometownheroesradio.com and you'll find instructions there on how to connect with Wes, who was motivated by photographs in a Japanese soldier's wallet that his father, Durrell, had brought home from the Battle of Okinawa. You get to take your dad back to the battlefield where he fought, where he had close calls, emotional moments like that. And you open your book, A Soldier's Journey, that you've painstakingly produced about your dad and the journey your whole family's been on. You open it with a pretty powerful scene of something you and he experienced together there on Okinawa. Can you share that with us?
On Okinawa, the government there today really places a lot of importance on what happened to that island during the war. I think it was a third of the population that was killed, and so for every school, all the school kids are all taught about the battle and the impact it had on the people, and they've created a beautiful memorial park, kind of similar to what our Vietnam Memorial might be. It has granite walls, a lot of granite walls. On those walls, they have engraved the names of every civilian that could be identified that was killed, as well as the Japanese soldiers, and we're talking tens of thousands. And I think there were 20-some thousand American soldiers killed in that battle. So the names of all the U.S. soldiers that were also killed are on those walls, and it's right on a cliff facing the ocean. Those cliffs are called suicide cliffs. It's where the final days of the battle, civilians and army members were pushed kind of right up there, and a lot took their own lives. They jumped off those cliffs. So anyway, so I felt to open the book, skipping ahead here, after the dad was invited by the research group and NHK, the media in Japan and Okinawa, to visit this memorial park where the name of the soldier was engraved on the wall. And this is the actual soldier that had creeped up to their foxhole. And so we were arriving at the park that day. It was a beautiful morning. There was just a light mist of rain, and with that rain was kind of some mist and fog, and it was warm. It was a perfect setting for what we were doing. We entered the park, and the flowers are all in bloom at that time of the year, and so we were having a little memorial service, I guess you would call it, at that place, the place on the wall where that soldier's name was engraved. And I think Dad was nervous about, it was the first time we were really going to be exposed to the media, you know, after finding the name of the soldier. And later on that day, there was to be a press conference about this U.S. soldier that had come back to the island. And he was a little nervous. There's a lot of people who would not be able to understand why this U.S. soldier was recognizing an enemy soldier, a Japanese soldier. But it's hard for them to understand that unless they knew the full story. But at any rate, that morning was just a beautiful setting as we walked down through those stones, and that's how I chose to start the book.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to skip over anything because, again, you said you had no expectation. This was a needle in a haystack to find that specific soldier who had been the owner of that wallet. What were the developments that led to that discovery?
Well, our first days there, the very first day, the morning we woke up, Alex Kishaba served as a guide. And he wanted to take us to see some parts of the island where the fighting had been. And part of what the U.S. soldiers had to do was there were a lot of caves on the island. In fact, the Japanese strategy was to have, you know, their forces sheltered until after the bombardment, and then wait until after the landing and then come out. So it was difficult to manage those caves. The civilians that were left tried to take shelter there, and so there was a lot of death that happened in those caves as the U.S. soldiers blew those caves up and used flamethrowers. And our first morning, they actually took Dad. He wanted to take Dad down this cave. It's well known. It's called the Cave of the Virgins.
This Alex, one of the stories he told, his mother was they'd go into these caves for some kind of protection. There was a bunch of sick Japanese soldiers and that down there. And his mother was a little girl, 12 years old or something like that. And it was her job to go down to the river and carry water up. And so she was kind of at the mouth of this cave. And they was going to blow this cave. I mean, that's hard, but that's a war. And she was by the mouth of this cave, and these soldiers come along, the U.S. soldiers. We come along. I didn't come along, but the U.S. soldiers come along, and they had to do something. They're going to blow that cave. Well, she ran off, and in the process, she wound up getting shot in the leg. Now, this Alex that Wes was mentioned, that was his mother. That little girl was his mother.
But if she hadn't run off, she would have been killed. He would have never been born. He wouldn't have been there to help you all along this process. And this Cave of the Virgins, you were starting to tell me, pretty memorable place.
Yeah, it was the first place we visited, and that's where he told us that story. And for the first time, I think in the excitement of getting us back, and the excitement of wanting to see the battlefields and being there with Dad, it never really struck me how it might affect him. You know, I never thought of that too much. And we went down in that cave, and it's still blackened, and, you know, and that's what it's meant for. They take school children, they want people to know what happened. And so we got down there, and Dad kind of, well, it was really tough.
I didn't go very far. It brought things back too quick, too fast, and so I turned and went. I told him I was going back up, and
it was just too painful for you to contemplate.
All of a sudden it was right there to me, and I had managed to kind of bury it for quite a few years. So I went back up, and then Wes can tell you kind of how it was.
Well, and I think this is, it's really valuable and important that you two are sharing this with us, because there's so many families that never had this opportunity that maybe thought about it. And there's so many families where the World War II veteran is no longer here and didn't talk about it, buried it, like you said. So by your telling your story, you're filling in a lot of blanks for a lot of other people too. And filling in blanks is kind of what this was all about. This has been a journey of discovery that if you never started, there's a lot you wouldn't understand now, Wes. What happened from there?
Well, I would have to say I was kind of devastated at that point. I just got thinking, what in the world have I done? But I could see now and began to see then that it was probably good. You know, it was a good thing. We got through with that. And, you know, like I say, that night I really had some second thoughts about what I had done. But we went on that day, and we discovered some other sites. And I think it was a way for Dad to face that. And we went on and had a good day. We had a book, the 96th Infantry Division book, with a lot of wartime photos. There were photographers embedded, Signal Corps photographers embedded with the division, and a lot of military, marine divisions, you know, a lot of pictures. And so the places where Dad had served, I had actual battlefield pictures. And so I was really interested to see if our guides could take us and we could locate those sites. So we were able to do that. Later on that day, Alex, once we got the Cave of the Virgins out of the way, he had set up a meeting with some local photographers and a newspaper, local newspaper publishers. And so later that day we met with them, and they were just actually excited about our trip. Part of our trip, Alex had succeeded in, I had sent him a few days earlier the names, and one wonderful photograph of a soldier with a really serene look on his face had his name on the back, and it was a soldier from Okinawa. It was not the soldier who owned the wallet, but this had his name and an address in Okinawa. And so we wanted to get that address out. The media met with us, and boy, the next morning are the reasons for our trip and the pictures of the photographs, and then this one particular photograph that had the Okinawa address on it were all in all the local media. That actually was a great kickstart to helping us to eventually identify the soldier who owned the wallet, as well as that soldier from Okinawa that was in that picture, who is also apparently a friend of the sergeant who had owned that wallet.
So that got the word out that this is happening, that you're looking for the owner. Were you thinking yet, hey, this might actually happen, or were you still kind of cooling your jets on that?
Oh, I would say after we had that meeting with the newspapers and all that, we were both genuinely excited about that. And maybe even to the point where the battlefield excursions were maybe a little secondary. Although those were important, we began to really get excited about what was happening on that regard. You know, in the next several days, the two former Marines who guided us, we succeeded in, you know, visiting actually the battlefield where Dad was in the foxhole, where he got the wallet and the Japanese soldier was killed. We visited that hill. We had pictures, and we actually stood on the location, you know, right where those things took place. That was exciting to me, and I think it was meaningful to Dad to be on those sites.
What was that like? To be back in that very spot where in a foxhole 66 years earlier, you had that intense experience.
Well, the main thing was the island was so devastated, so all the vegetation was shattered. There was so much stuff on the ground, and here we was all these years later. I couldn't believe how it had been built up and how green everything was. That's where that lion, what do you call him?
The Tomari lion, which has been there for centuries.
Yeah, and here shows part of our unit crouched around that lion, and you can see all the bright white spots on the lion where bullets had hit that lion, and it just a little chip had come off. You could just count them, and all these guys had crouched down there. Here we was looking at that lion, and it just amazed me how Okinawa had changed in those years.
Yeah, this ancient sculpture, which had been cover for American soldiers against the Japanese, was now a tourist attraction once again. What about the quest, though, Wes? What were the developments that came next?
Sometime in that 2 or 3 day period, Alex called us at the hotel very excited and said there was an item in the wallet, and I haven't discussed that before now. There were the photographs, but maybe the most interesting item in there was a little white envelope that was sealed. And on the front of that envelope, some really fine writing. I don't know how the name for Japanese writing, but Japanese characters, you know, vertical line of those, a couple lines, and then a seal, like someone's personal seal in wax. That actually turned out to be an envelope that belonged to the owner of the wallet, and it contained strands of his hair, pieces of his hair, short clippings, actually, along with a fingernail clipping. But off the cover of that little envelope was his name and his unit number. So it was almost like what we'd have a dog tag. It was part of a religious belief for the Japanese soldiers. We found out later that if the contents of that envelope were able to get back to his home, even though he never did, that it would allow his spirit to return home. And so this research group was pretty excited. They had known about that practice, but never really had seen one of these envelopes. It never survived. You know, all those soldiers probably carried them, but they all just disappeared with the soldiers into the island. So they were excited to tell us they had ID'd him. His name was indeed engraved on the wall at the memorial, and they were now researching in Japan to see if they could locate his family. So the morning of about the fourth day, when we went and held the little memorial service, we were at his name. And later that day, Dad was interviewed by Stars and Stripes magazine and NHK, and there was an American photographer along. Later that day, they contacted us with the exciting news that they had located in Japan this soldier's home and discovered that he had a 2-year-old daughter at the time he was killed, and that she was still alive. That was the night before we were to leave, actually, for Okinawa, and of course that became just the most exciting news that we could imagine, and that they were in the midst of trying to contact her. And so Dad's intention at that point was to leave the wallet with the research group for them to give her the wallet back. And, you know, it was hard to leave Okinawa. The weather was perfect the whole time, and these developments, it was just the most exciting thing you can imagine, the way it turned out and how we felt that we were divinely led every step of the way. And it wasn't so much our doing. The doors were opened, you know, just as we needed them. That morning, as we were just getting ready to board the plane to leave for the U.S., Dad looked at me and he said, "Wes, I want to be the one to give her that wallet." So we had left it. We were boarding the plane. You know, I would have to say it was a little deja vu. When he said initially that he wanted to return the wallet, I thought, oh man, how are we going to do that? And here it had happened. And as we got on the plane, I don't think I'd learned my lesson. I thought to myself again, how in the world are we going to get to Japan and meet this soldier's daughter? Or will she even want to meet with us? But that started a whole another part of this journey.
And somebody knew exactly how it was all going to come about. But Durrell, I want to ask you, because you'd had this wallet for 66 years since you picked it up off the side of that foxhole, you knew it belonged to the soldier that had lost that hand-to-hand combat struggle with you in that foxhole. But you didn't know his name. When they were able to go through the contents of that wallet and find his name and put a name to that face you'd seen and that wallet you'd had, was that meaningful to you?
Well, sure. And it was meaningful for them, too. Because, see, we was boarding the plane. I left the wallet hoping they could find. Yeah. Well, these develops happened as we was boarding the plane.
What changed for you that made you want to do it?
Well, I don't know. I do not know. I guess I just wanted to meet her. I wasn't realizing what that might entail. She might have been really bitter. When they found her, they told her the story that they had the wallet. On top of what I said, this research group, they sent the wallet back. They wanted me to come and give it to her. They wanted to see that happen.
And there are a lot of things that can, a lot of hurdles that need to be cleared. You've got a language barrier, you're going through intermediaries, you don't really know how she feels, it's a sensitive situation. But before we go any further, maybe I should have you mention the name of that Japanese soldier, because I'm sure it's a name you haven't forgotten since you finally were made aware of it.
Sergeant Kijiro Hocho. Before we get to that point, I want to tell you, I mentioned that one of the photographs had the image of a soldier from Okinawa who was fighting for Japan. A lot of the civilians didn't. They were forced into service, but apparently some did. This soldier, whose at least his address was Okinawa, the next morning after the interview with the newspaper, that came out, and they showed his picture and what we were doing. Well, that man's daughter saw the picture of her father, realized it was her father. So that was the man from Okinawa. He'd survived the war, and anyway, she recognized that picture. He had a family in Okinawa there. He died in 2015, but they arranged us to meet with her that afternoon so Dad could give her that picture of her father back, and she was just floored and emotional and holding on to Dad and hugging him, and she was so excited. She only had one picture of her father as a soldier. He just closed himself off from the war and never mentioned it, so she didn't know much about it. And so here she was with this picture, and that was a high point of our experience in Okinawa. She brought along her father's brother, in other words, her uncle, who was really elderly at that point, and he looked at the picture and the writing, and he said, "Yep, that's my brother's writing, and that's my brother." And so that was exciting. That made us, I think, look forward to this meeting with possibly with this Hojo's daughter.
Well, I guess, Daryl, it kind of sounds like every time you see the impossible become possible, you start to think more impossible things are possible.
Right. And, you know, that's when you look at life in general, that happens all the time. It just makes a difference in our lives.
Little did Daryl and Wes Gibbs know how many lives would be touched by the journey they were on, but we're going to hear about the culmination of their quest when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and a video with Wes and Daryl, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, working our way to the culmination of a pilgrimage that ultimately began in a foxhole on Okinawa when a young American in the 96th Infantry Division survived a hand-to-hand struggle with an enemy soldier. That soldier's wallet held clues to his identity. We've been talking to World War II veteran Daryl Gibbs and his son Wes about the incredible journey the photos in that wallet took them on. If you'd like to order the book Wes has written about it, you can find instructions at hometownheroesradio.com. You know who the soldier was. You know his daughter, who was 2 when he was killed, is still living. Don't know if she wants to meet with you or talk to you. But all these things fall into place, and you've got a plan to go to Japan, and you're even taking your siblings along too, not just your dad.
Yeah, as we got home and began to make this plan, NHK, the Japanese public television or public media, really stepped up at that point, really volunteered along with the Okinawa Research Group. NHK took on the task of helping organize this meeting with Hojo's daughter. It was January when we left Okinawa. We planned to go in March. We were going to go right away. NHK decided that they wanted to do a documentary on this, on these two soldiers that had met on the battlefield, and they wanted to do a documentary of this. And so they did. They lined up a crew to come to the ranch, you know, to photograph and film Dad in his setting, his life now. And so their documentary plan to kind of follow these two soldiers from childhood on. And so that happened in February. They came out to the ranch, and we fixed them all dinner, and they really enjoyed the trip to Montana. So our date was set. Our tickets were purchased, and then the earthquake, that major earthquake hit in Japan at that point, and that threw everything up in the air. It actually hit at about the time we would have been close to being there, I think. And so everything was on hold, and we didn't even know if Hojo's daughter had, you know, survived. She lived on the coast in northern Japan, Iwate Prefecture, a town called Morioka. So NHK stayed in close touch with us as the infrastructure was repaired enough for the trip. They let us know that she was fine, her house was damaged. Then they gave us some background information. You know, following the war, she and her mother had had a very rough life, as most Japanese did. Her mother, of course, a widow. This little girl was two. They were on the street. The soldier, Sergeant Hojo, had been a landowner. They had kind of a family well established there, but that land went to another male heir, and she and the daughter were basically on their own. And so when this Hojo's daughter was in a teen, the mother passed away, and she was on her own. And so life had been pretty hard. So they were filling us in a little bit as we made the plans to go to Japan. As soon as the infrastructure was available for us to go, Delta Airlines, to their credit, just let us kind of hold the tickets and use them when we could go. And so we planned that trip, and that took place in April. I told my brother and sister, there's three of us in our family, I said, you weren't able to go to Okinawa, but you can't miss this. And they said the same thing. We've got to be a part of this. We're going to meet Hojo's daughter. You know, and we'd been told, we didn't quite know what to expect totally. The Japanese interpreter had told us, you know, Japanese protocol, don't touch her. You know, she's going to be standoffish. You know, we just didn't quite know what to expect. And we landed in Japan, and NHK was there to meet us and get us in our hotels. And Dad, I don't think he got any sleep, you know, that night. The next morning, we were going to take the bullet train and meet Hojo's daughter, and he was so concerned about what the reception might be. We just still didn't quite know. You know, nobody said, she's excited to meet you. She's agreed to, and that's about all we knew. And so the next morning, a quick bullet train ride from Tokyo to Morioka took place. And I want to mention, Dad's an old cowboy, and so he wears a Stetson hat. And he had his white Stetson on, and so the media was aware we were coming. And even in Okinawa, people on the street would honk and say, cowboy, and everybody knew his Stetson hat. Well, we got to Tokyo, and, you know, we were the only guys walking down the street with a guy with a big white Stetson. And so everybody knew him and knew what our mission was. And we arrived in Morioka. They wired Dad up for sound. NHK was going to film this meeting. And we were informed that Hojo's daughter, her name was Noriko Kikuchi, you know, that she'd had a rough life, but she was kind of retired now and lived in a small home. And as we unloaded the van and walked up this path to her home, everything was nice and neat and clean. She had made a sign and pasted it to the door of her home that said, "Welcome, Mr. Gibbs." And instead of not wanting him to touch her, she kind of rushed to Dad and took a hold of his arm. Just held on to his arm. We were following kind of behind them in a little entourage of media. So we all entered her home, which was maybe half the size of this room we're sitting in right here, but very neat and clean. She had some fresh fruit there for us and a low table. We all knelt around that little table. So we had an interpreter. I mean, she couldn't speak English, and of course we couldn't speak Japanese. She was just very exuberant. And then as we knelt down, it seemed like she was a little bit subdued. And Dad presented her this wallet and the contents, and she took it out. And the interpreter, Dad relayed some of the information about the circumstances that he'd obtained it. She asked him if her father was alive when he first saw him, and Dad said yes, and she said, was he dead when you last saw him? And Dad said yes. And then she asked, I thought, a pretty important question. She said, were you both fighting for your lives? And of course, the answer to that is yes, you know. And she seemed content to me. Did you get that idea, Dad? She seemed content to know that that any one of them could have lost their lives. She seemed content in the knowledge that it was every man for himself, I guess, at that point. She seemed content in that. The discussion got around to each man was fighting to stay alive. That was the words. Each man fought to stay alive.
And I know there's something else that she said that held deep meaning, but I want to ask you, Daryl, when you're walking up, what's going through your mind? Before you see that sign, before she comes and grabs your arm, what were you thinking?
Well, the day before, I started thinking how serious we was going to meet the Japanese soldier's daughter. She was 2 years old when he died, and all she ever knew about her dad was what she got from her mother. You know, she don't remember at 2 years. And here, the soldier that was partially responsible for her dad's death, I say partially because there were two of us in that foxhole. Here she's going to meet the guy that's going to give her dad's wallet, was the guy that had a hand in her dad's death. For me, I wondered what I should say. Like Wes said, you don't want to show any emotion. That's what Alex said too. He said, don't show any emotion or anything like that. Well, how do you go through something like that and not show emotion?
So when you saw that sign in English saying, welcome, Mr. Gibbs, and then she walks out and reaches toward you, yeah, and grabs your arm, can you help us understand what that felt like?
Well, it relieved me because I was free to show what any emotion. She was showing all kinds of emotion, and I did too. Wes did too. All of us, it was an emotional situation.
And to be able to take this wallet that you've had for 66 years and hand it to her, what was that like?
Well, by then, after quite a few hours a night and part of a day, being stressed on how I wanted to do things right, but how was you going to do what we had to do and not show emotion? See, all of a sudden, all that was released because she showed the emotion, and then we was relieved. We knew, well, we was going to show emotion anyway. I mean, you don't do things like that and not show any emotion.
And the envelope that you'd never been allowed to open was opened.
Actually, Dad had opened it a little before then to kind of see what was in it, to satisfy his curiosity. And he'd always told us he felt that it was probably a sweetheart's hair. You know, that's what a U.S. soldier would do.
Yeah, sure.
And didn't quite realize what those short hair clippings were until the research group then filled us in. But Dad was very careful with it. And
I opened it, yeah, and the minute I seen that short hair,
yeah,
I just closed it up. Yeah. The whole thing was, when she opened it, there was a fingernail there in the bottom. I didn't know that fingernail was there.
She laid out a piece of tissue paper, I think, on this table in front of us, and she carefully poured that out. Poured out the hair and the fingernail and touched them. And, you know, it was just very, very, very emotional, thoughtful. She carefully put those back in the envelope. And, you know, and their beliefs, I think I explained that before. She said to Dad then, I can't remember right if it was right then or just a little while later, a few minutes later, she said to Dad, you've brought my father home. So from the house, we actually went out, and there, a short distance away was a temple, a Buddhist temple, I think is what it was.
She wanted me to go with her to that worship place so that for her dad's spirit to be there at that shrine, they had to have something that he had had, and this wallet and that fingernail and all that stuff. She wanted me to go there and be with her when she put that back there. That was the hardest part of my being, because those two guides, the two Marines, they said, be careful of what you say, because they might use that so that the cause of the war isn't just all Japan's fault. Be careful what you say. Well, how many soldiers lost their lives in the death march? See, that was in my head. How many families that lost loved ones, they hate the Japanese. See? So here, American soldier, after this experience, is there with this Japanese lady, so her father's spirit can be there at the place of reverence. That was awfully hard for me to go there, because I felt like I was on the wrong side of the fence.
And Wes, I got the sense that even though you all knew it would be meaningful for the family, the depth of that meaning for her was more evident because of that ceremony?
Yes, it was a great closure, you know, for her. She'd never, I don't think, really had given her dad a thought with her rough life. It sounded like there were other family relatives of his and hers that she'd never met that were there for this meeting. And so it seemed really, we could see them visiting together. It was the first time she'd ever met them. She had not been a part of that family, really. And so they were there. And I know Dad was worried about that, knew that, and we discussed that. You know, and it wasn't a political or a military reason we were there, but to help that family find some closure, too, the same way we had. So I think it was a great, great blessing for both families, regardless of, you know, he was Japanese, Dad was U.S. That's the way that was.
And Durrell, what was the biggest takeaway for you from this whole saga?
Well, before, when I talked about they were Japs, and all of a sudden, I can't do that anymore. They're Japanese. We found out they have the same problems we have. They have three meals a day, hopefully. They have a life of their own. They're Japanese. Suddenly, it don't seem right when I say the word Japs, and that's just the way it is. And that's how people can change. Hate can do a lot of damage, and something has to happen to heal it. So now they're Japanese.
And for you, Wes, you never knew where this was going to go. You didn't know all the twists and turns it was going to take on the way to that culmination you just shared with us. But what have you learned from this whole process?
No, you're right. When we went to Okinawa, we had just no idea of what was in front of us. But I think I learned, and I see now more clearly, you know, that when you're on a mission for good, and that's the way this was, you know, it was purely, well, aside from the battlefield visits and the historical part of it, that's something I'll always remember and treasure. And I took hundreds of photographs, and, you know, that's a record for our family. But on the human side of it, that's much more important, I think, for both of our families. And I feel very firmly that just because of the value of that mission to both families, the doors were opened, you know, by the Lord, by whoever you think the higher power is. We were helped to find our way in a way that it just became clear each day. And now looking back, I see that so much good, you know, was done for her family, for her, how I've thought often now, you know, how life must be for her. I have a marvelous picture of my sister and her together. And I thought that was really, really a touching picture, because here's two daughters of these two soldiers, you know, at the soldiers that met on the battlefield. And here's the two daughters side by side. I just think it's been a tremendous amount of closure for both families, you know, a meaningful way to move on and find peace. And so I think we were helped to accomplish that, and that people who want to accomplish something like that will be helped along, whatever the situation and circumstances might be.
Well said. And why did you feel it was important to put this book together?
I'm very strong a proponent of recording. Just what you're doing is marvelous, and I do the same thing. Our veterans are these people with stories, men and women, of World War II, sometime in my lifetime, and it's not very far away, there will be a newspaper story that says the last living World War II veteran passed away today. And I think there's so much to record, you know, for people to learn about later, particularly families of those individuals. So what you're doing is great. I wanted to put together something for our family and other people who would have an interest in it, and to be able to see how, you know, a soldier's journey started clear back when he was a boy and led along these paths that, you know, weren't planned, but the way was open to do something marvelous for somebody else and to help somebody else along their way. And I wanted that this book, which isn't a real lengthy book, but a record of that. So I have a lot of photographs in there, and I decided to write it from my point of view. I didn't know how else to write it. I kept a journal throughout our trip, and, you know, along the way, I would send emails home with the day's events and a whole bunch of pictures from the day. I'd stay up until midnight that night, kind of putting this together. It started out with family members, and before I knew it, it was being forwarded to hundreds of people.
Well, let me ask you, Daryl, what does it mean to you that your son would do all this, would go to all this trouble? Because it wouldn't have happened without his initiative.
Well, no, if he hadn't... He had to do all, he kept all the records. He had to put that book together. If it hadn't have been for Wes and his talents, it takes talent to do that. If it hadn't have been for Wes, that story would have died with me. And what good was the story? We got a letter from one of the directors of the NHK saying that after her experience with seeing this story develop and watching it develop, she wrote in that letter that there should never, ever be another war. That was from a member of the NHK. There should never, ever be another war. So you can draw your own conclusions. I think that the whole thing is something that is special.
No doubt. And the ripple effects of it are going to go on and on. And one of the little side ripples here is... you're doing stuff like this to bless other families. Here's a Japanese family that never really knew what happened to this 2-year-old daughter's father. There's over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II, and a lot of people don't know their stories. And you're part of a grassroots effort called Stories Behind the Stars that seeks to document each and every one of those with enough of a story for us to get to know who this person was, who this Gold Star hero really was. I think the goal is to have them all done by the 80th anniversary of the end of the war in 2025. How many of those have you participated in, and why do you keep doing that?
Well, I do. I like to write. I like to research, and I like to try to impact people's lives, I guess. So I guess I serve as a volunteer to write those Gold Star stories, and, you know, maybe 15 to 20 or so. But there's others who do way more than that. There's a whole team of people who are doing this. But I guess what I get out of it is, you know, I research that person's life from their birth to when they gave their life, you know, on Normandy or wherever. Everybody's story is so unique and so touching, and I try to write their story in a way that shows their family life and about their parents, you know, what they liked to do when they were in school, and, you know, how they were motivated to enter the service. And you can find out so much of that just by researching records. You know, I think it's a wonderful effort, and I feel privileged to be a part of it and wish I could do more.
Well, I'm sure there's a few people out there listening who are willing to do some of those and can sign up at storiesbehindthestars.org and be a volunteer just like Wes in that manner. If there's anything else, Wes, that you'd like to share, feel free. And I'm also interested if there's anything else you'd like to say about your dad, because it's pretty clear that you have a great respect and admiration and devotion to him. You wouldn't have done all this otherwise.
Well, yeah, I have deep feelings about my dad and who he is, you know, who he's become, what he's done, where he started, and the impact he's had on my life. When I think about if things had turned out different in that foxhole, it would have, of course, impacted all of us deeply, just as it did that soldier's daughter and perhaps other children he would have had. But no, I think my dad's 97, and I'll be sitting here watching TV with him or something and and look at him and realize, you know, where he's been. What experiences you've had. One of the things I'm most grateful for is that I've been able to, you know, help other people know those, but they're experiences that I hope can be inspirational in some way. You know, we all want to impact people for good. We all want our legacies are different. We live in different situations in the world, but everybody has a story. They have personal impact on others. Dad's impact on me is, of course, immeasurable. And I know that. I know of his personal story. And so that's why I do Stories Behind the Stars and other things. I just, hopefully those personal stories cannot be forgotten and have a personal impact.
You know, Durrell, there's two questions I try to ask at the end of any one of these interviews. First, there's something I have to say. I can't forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for letting us into this story, this journey, this adventure you've been on that is blowing a lot of people's minds right now, I'm sure. But when you think back on 97 years on this planet, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, it's brought a sense of an awareness of what the Lord can do in our lives. Regardless of what we be, the beliefs we have, the Lord is with us, and it's up to us to the extent that knowing that can help or deter us. It's up to us. They talked about me being 97. That isn't half of it. You know, we've got goals. I've got a goal. I want to be the oldest World War II vet alive. It looks like maybe I'll have to stick around another 10 years. But I aim to do that. And by letting people know that that's my goal, you'd be amazed at how many people is trying to, they're trying to help me get there. When I hear thanks for going to the service and thanks for helping defend our country, that thanks needs to go both ways. Because I think we, as veterans, we owe a gratitude, a lot of thanks to the way the citizens of this nation has accepted us. Well, so that thanks goes both ways.
As I put the book together about Dad and thought a lot about him, you know, it's been a wonderful example to me of somebody who came back from that terrible experience, you know, met my mother and just picked up. And there were rough times. My grandmother would talk about, you know, nightmares and things like that. And Dad faced a lot of that, I'm sure. But he'd come back and, you know, just picked up and went forward with hope. I'm sure there's more rough times than I ever know about, but I appreciate my dad's mental attitude. You know, it's always can do, will do. And attitude is really important. And adversity was just something to be overcome. And I love him for that wonderful example. He, you know, when we were little, I know there were some after effects, you know, when we were on the ranch raising livestock. And, you know, Dad had he dealt with a temper and profanity and other leftovers from the war, but we all got through that together, and he kept our family together. It was always a positive attitude.
One more question. Do you have any advice for someone who might be listening? And maybe it was a relative in American Armed Forces. Maybe they do have something that belonged to an enemy soldier, and they've always wondered, what can I do? Should I even try to reunite this with who it belongs to? You have any advice for somebody like that?
Yeah, I would say even if that soldier's passed on and their family has something like that, there's a great possibility that that can have just an immeasurable impact, you know, and to seek out, to go ahead and step forward and to have some faith and see what good can be done. You know, the war and all of that, we just don't think about the impact that it's had on families enough. And so anybody could contact me personally if they wanted to, or other sources. There are people and ways to help see any avenue possible to stay in touch, you know, with others, with other families, do some good with that. Try to get that stuff back to where maybe you'd like it to end up. You know, what was taken as maybe a war souvenir now can have quite a meaningful impact. I often think of Noriko Kikuchi, and she has that wallet in her hands. You know, the last personal possession on earth that belonged to her father. And she has that. And I know there are other similar situations possibly that could really have an impact on family members.
In other words, the journey is always worth it, and you never know how it may end up. If you'd like to contact Wes Gibbs about that or even order his book, A Soldier's Journey, I have that information for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And if you're ever in Fort Benton, Montana, Wes and Durrell won't be too hard to find. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. There are a few more comments from father and son that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time, but are featured in the podcast version online. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.